We're holding on your test summit bays 10 lines from the bottom. We're still in the middle of talking about various cases where Adim say about their, Adim give Adris about their own signatures. So we talked about when they have a Pesha also a Pesha Hitter, and therefore we can believe them when they say that even though these are their signatures, the signatures were obtained by force or whatever, versus when do we not say that? When we have their signatures, when Yiksav Yadam Yotzim Makom Acher, when we have independent confirmation of their signatures. So now, further on this topic, Tana Rabbanan, Shnayim Chasumin al Ashtar, if you have two people signed on a Ashtar, Umesu, and those two people died, Uvo Shnayim in Ashuk V'omru, two people from the street come and say to give Edus, which is one of the valid ways of being Mekayim, the signatures on a Ashtar. You can have other people that testify on the signatures. So these other people say, Yadainush Ksav Yadamu, we know that this is their handwriting, so therefore these are their signatures. Aval anusim hoyu, but they were anusim. So in the Mishnah we had a case where the Edim themselves are saying about their own signatures that we were anusim or we were ktanim or what have you. Here it's not they themselves are saying, here it's third parties. And by the way, the Ritva points out it doesn't have to be necessarily that the original Edim are dead, but practically speaking that's usually when you would have other people coming to be Mekayim instead of them. But yes, the same thing would apply, of course, if they were still alive and they just were out of town or whatever. Anyway, so these other Edim are coming and saying that they were anusim, that they were forced to sign it, or ktanim hoyu, or they were children, or psule edus hoyu, or that they were psule edus, which again, psule edus can mean two different kinds of things. It can mean they're posel because of, well, three different kinds of things, really. It can mean they were posel on the grounds of averus. It can mean that they were posel on the grounds of being close relatives, or it can mean that they were posel on the grounds that at the time they were avadim, and afterwards they were freed. Anyway, so these other people are saying that they were psule edus. Harei le nemonim, then we believe them, because after all, hapesha also hapesha hitzer. V'im yesh edim shaksav yadam huzeh, but if we have other edim, that this is their handwriting, so we have Reuven and Shimon sign on the shtar, Levi and Yehuda come and verify that it's their signatures, now Yisachar and Zvulun come and say that they were anusim or what have you, or if we had their signatures on file from something else, so from a different place, specifically the Braisa says, Mishtar Shakara Olav Arar Vahuchsuk Rebastin, specifically when we have another shtar that had previously been questioned, that had previously been brought to Bastin with a question on it, whether in fact somebody had claimed, in fact, that it was forged, so they brought it to Bastin and verified it, Vahuchsuk Rebastin, and it was verified in Bastin. They did a kiyum on it. So such a shtar is stronger even than one that did not have an ear on it. The Rebbe used to talk about that a lot of times in Sichas. We see the idea that something that was questioned and then confirmed is in a way stronger than something that never went through such questioning in the first place. And that applies, for example, to Teres Achsidus, where originally there was tremendous isnagdus to it and tremendous questioning of whether it's a valid derech in Torah, and eventually it was shown that it is. So therefore, that makes it much stronger than had there never been that challenge in the first place. Anyway, so here we're saying the same kind of thing. So if we have a shtar that had been challenged and then was verified and based in, then such a thing, we can use that to verify now another shtar to compare the signatures. There was actually a machlokas who showed him on that. Doesn't mean davka, only when it was like that, only when it was questioned and then confirmed, the Rama says that a davka has to be because only then is based in extra careful to make sure that it really is correct since it was questioned. On the other hand, the Rosh says not necessarily. I mean, usually when would you bring a shtar to based in for verification is when a question has been raised about it. But really, the same din would be if it had been verified just even without such a challenge. Anyway, so in such a case, in that case, the Edim that come and say that the original Edim who signed the Shtar were anusim or what have you, then we're not going to believe them because then again we don't have a Pesha al Sar Pesha Heter. So the Gemara asks, what do you mean, Ein Elu Ne'emonim? So what are you telling me then? We're going to collect with such a shtar as if it was perfectly good, as if there was absolutely no question that it's good? How could we? Isn't it two Edim against two Edim? You have, after all, two Edim that signed it. You have two other Edim that are coming and saying that they were anusim. So fine. We can't say that we passel the shtar completely because they don't have that pesher asar pesher hetir. But nevertheless, they still are saying that they were anusim or ketanim or what have you. How can we ignore them? How can we ignore them completely? At best, what we should say is we have a suffix, and you can't take away money based on a suffix. So Amar of Sheshes, sort of Sheshes answers, Zoyse meres hachosha tchilas hazamahi. We see from this that hachosha is the beginning of hazama. In other words, what happens? When you have Reuben and Shimon come and testify in Beis Din, and later on you have Levi and Yehuda come and contradict them, there's two possibilities. Levi and Yehuda can come and say it's not true, for example, Reuben wasn't in town at that time, or they refute their edus in some other way. They say that you're testifying that he lent him money, but in fact he already paid it back or whatever. You have many different possible cases like that. That kind of thing is called akhosha. So we say when you have akhosha, the fact is we don't know which set of edim to believe. Both sets of edim are kosher, so we don't know. One of them must be lying. We don't know which one. So therefore, we have to throw out the whole thing, and we say that we consider the thing a suffix. But hazama is when the second set of edim come and say, as far as the actual facts that you're saying, as far as, for example, that Reuben killed Shimon in such and such a place, or that Reuben was Machal Shabbos, or that Reuben lent Shimon money in such and such a place, or whatever, maybe, maybe not, we don't know about that. What we do know is you can't be giving edus about it, because you yourselves, Imanu Hayisim, you were with us elsewhere. And then we say, the Torah tells us, Vastisim Lo Kasha Zaman, we punish the first set of edim with whatever they were going to cause to the person they were testifying against. So now, Rav Sheshes is saying that hakhosha is in effect the first stage of hazama. So therefore, in other words, there's a certain comparison between hazama and hakhosha. So, and in what sense are they the same? In the sense of shem she'in mazimin es edim ela b'fneihem, just like when it comes to hazama, you can only do it in the presence of the original edim, and that we know for sure, because that's going to involve that there's going to be a penalty of some kind for the first set of edim, and you can't testify against a person when he's not present. So therefore, of necessity, we have to have the first set of edim there in order for hazama to take place. So the same way, if Sheshes says kachin machishin es edim al b'fneihem, the same way you can only do akhosha in the presence of the original edim. Well, here you can't because the original edim died. Therefore, we can't consider that a true akhosha, and therefore. So that's what we mean. When we say, does that mean that we can actually collect with this shtar? Rav Sheshes is saying, in effect, yes, because we can't really consider the fact that the second set of edim, Mela, if they came and said, yes, these are their signatures, but they were anusim, okay, apesha asa, apesha hitzer. For that, we don't need them to be present, because we wouldn't have needed them to be present for the original kiyum either, and with the very kiyum that they're saying that these are their signatures, they're also saying these signatures are no good because of a side reason. But when it comes to, if you have other edim testifying about it, or if they have their signature on a different shtar, and that which they're comparing to this one, and now these guys are coming and saying they were anusim, we have to say we can't accept that hakasha because the original edim are not present. But Amalei Reb Nachman, says I can't agree with that. Ilu have a kamano makishin lahu. Consider what would happen if the original edim were actually here in front of us. Let's say they weren't dead. Let's say they actually were here in front of us when this shtar is being brought to Beis Din. Umakishin lahu, and the second set of edim contradict them and say that they were anusim or what have you. Have akhosha. After all, it would be a valid akhosha. V'loy have a mashgichin lahu. We wouldn't pay any attention to the edim of the shtar themselves, mishum dehavalei edus mukheshes, because we would say, after all, their edus has been refuted. So now, because they're not here, de'ilu havalei kamon d'yoma hava moidelahu, and after all, had they been present, maybe they would have agreed, maybe they would have admitted that, you know what, we were anusim or otherwise psulim. Now, it's true, Maram Schiff points out, it's true we wouldn't necessarily believe them because we would say, Kivin Shehigid Shuvay Nechoze or Magid. Once they testified by signing on the shtar, we don't allow them to recant their testimony and say something different. So that's true. Still, though, the fact is that they would still be saying, and we'd still have to give it some degree of weight, more so than if they're contradicting the other Edim. So if they were here, they might well have been moida, and then we could accept that the second set of edim are in fact telling the truth, that these guys were anusim or whatever. So now Mehemni. So now we should believe the first set of Edim just because they're not present. What's the logic? In fact, the Ritva points out there's another angle on what Rav Nachman is saying as well. When it comes to Hazama, where the Edom are getting punished, sure, you need it to be Bifneim. But when it comes to Hakosha, the Edom, you're not doing anything to the first set of Edom as a result of the Hakosha. All you're doing is you're saying you're throwing out their Edus. So why should that have to be in their presence? Rav Nachman says no. In fact, we do accept the second set hakosha, and we say uki trei lahadi trei. We put two against two, and therefore we have them contradicting. Uki mamone b'cheskas marei, and we leave the mamon in the chazaka of its original owner because we don't have solid proof one way or the other. We don't know whether the shtar is valid. We don't know whether it's invalid, so we can't take away money on the grounds of it. In fact, the idea would be then we can't collect with it, but we're also not going to rip it up either. If we said that it was invalid, if we said that in fact if we accepted the second set of Edom and said they were anusim, not only we wouldn't collect with it, but we would actually rip it up. So we can't try to collect with it in the future. But here we don't do that. Rashi also adds then that therefore if he is toifus, if the person who has the shtar does go and grab nechosim from the other guy in payment of what it says in the shtar, then we can't take it away from him because still we have a suffix over here. So he can't take away money on the basis of a suffix. Tosfos discusses a little bit about the ins and outs of that. When do we say that tefisa would help? When would say that not? Tosfos also points out one possibility is that we're not talking about over here about a shtar halva, about a shtar where it says that Reuven borrowed money from Shimon, but rather we're talking about a shover. On the contrary, we're talking about a receipt that says that Reuven paid Shimon. So now, if we don't accept the edim on the shtar, then we would say that we would say he doesn't have to pay because we assume that the edim on the receipt are kosher. Okay, so therefore, according to Rav Nachman, that's what we do. And Rav Nachman adds, midi dehava an nichsid bar shatya. We can compare this with the case of the nechosim of bar shatya. Bar shatya literally means the shoita. And some bar doesn't always mean son. Sometimes it means somebody who has the characteristics of, just like a bar mitzvah, somebody who has the characteristics of being chayiv in mitzvahs. Anyway, so Bar Shatya was a person who sometimes was normal and sometimes was crazy. He had some kind of intermittent mental disease that sometimes he was normal and sometimes not. So there was a case, the Bar Shatya Zabin Nichsi. There was a time when Bar Shatya sold some property when everything was written in a shtar and everything seems to be on the up and up. But now, later on, the question becomes, did he do it when he was a shoita or did he do it when he was normal? Also beit tere amri kshur shoita zabin. So two edim came and said that he did it when he was a shoita, and in that case, then it's worthless. Also beit tere v'amri kshur cholim zabin, and then two other edim came and said that he sold it when he was normal. So we have two edim against two edim. Omer Ravashi said, Ravashi says, well, that's exactly what we do. Just like Rav Nachman had just said, uki trei lahadi trei, we put two against two, so therefore we have to throw out the whole edus. V'uki mamona v'cheskes bar shatya, so we leave the mamon in the chazaka of bar shatya. Namely, in other words, we say that the karaka we're talking about, as the Gemara is going to say in a second, that this Tosfos points out that we have to be talking about karaka. If it was metaltalin, then actually we would say they're in the chazaka of whoever has possession of them right now. Karaka, of course, you don't have that, so therefore, because karaka is not movable, so therefore you go according to the chazaka that he originally had. It's called Zaka de Mi'ikra, and therefore you leave it in the possession of Bar Shatya. You would need solid proof that he was in fact normal when he did this when he did this transaction. And the Gemara says, "V'loyam moron elad isle chazaka dava ase." Now, though, that would only apply if the property, if Bar Shatya has a chazaka on it as a result of it having previously been from his own ancestors. So then, there's no question that it was his. And then, if somebody else wants to take it away from him, then they need some kind of proof. But if he himself doesn't even have chazaka from his fathers, he himself bought it at some point, then Then we have every right to say that he was a shoita when he bought it, and he was a shoita when he sold it, and therefore we have no reason to consider that he's the muchzik in it and say that he should be able to keep it, then we have just as much reason to say that it should belong to the original owner who he bought it from, or that it should belong to the new person who just bought it from him now. Because one way or the other, there's no solid evidence that he ever had ownership of it in the first place. Okay. Going back to, we said earlier on the Amud that Rav Sheshes has held that Hazama and Hakasha are similar in effect. He said that Hakasha is the beginning of Hazama. In other words, they're both they have a certain similarity. The process of Hazama involves a certain degree of Hakasha, because you're denying, you're confuting, you're contradicting what the other Edim said. They said that such and such happened, and you're saying that it didn't happen, or you're saying that it may have happened, but you were someplace else, which is Hazama. So now Rav Sheshes had said before that Akasha is the beginning of that process, and therefore that Akasha also has to take place in the presence of the Edim. So now, discussing further that point, the Gemara says, Omar Rabbo, Edim Mazimina se Edim Ela Bifnehen, you can only be Mazim Edim only in their own presence, like we said before, because after all, you're going to be punishing them, and therefore they need to be present. But to do Akasha, you can do even Shaloi Bifnehem, which is like Rav Nachman, not like Rav Sheshes. And Rav Abahu also adds, V'hazama Shaloi Bifnehem. Furthermore, what if two other Edim came and did do Hazama, but it was not in the presence of the original Edim? So what if Reuven and Shimon came and said that Ploini was Mechalal Shabbos, and... Well, let's say, for example, since we're talking about over here, Dini Mominus. So they come and say that Ploini, they came and say that Ploini lent money to Ploini. And then Levi and Yehuda come and say, with Reuven and Shimon not being present, that actually Reuven and Shimon were elsewhere with us at the time. So Reuven and Shimon are not there when Levi and Yehuda are coming. Then Rabbi Bohu says, Nihida Hazama Lehavia. It's true, we won't consider it Hazama, so we won't give Reuven and Shimon whatever penalty in this case that they'd have to pay back the money that they wanted to make the other guy, that they wanted to make the other guy lose. Hakosha Miyahavia. Nevertheless, it is a valid Hakosha. This is following his own Shitta and Rabbi Nachman's Shitta, that the Hakosha doesn't have to be in the presence of the Edim, so it is a valid Hakosha, so therefore the Edus is Bottle. So now you have a machloikas about that, where the Rivosh says that we believe the second ones completely, and we completely toss out the Edus of the first ones. So it wouldn't even be a matter of suffix. It would be that we'd say it's a vadai that the first ones are liars and the second one we believe, because the only reason usually when it comes to regular hakasha, we have no reason to believe one over the other. When it comes to Hazama, it's Gzeres HaKosov, that we believe the second ones, and therefore, even though here it's not true Hazama, because it's not Bifneim, nevertheless, the Rivosh holds it would still have the Dinim of Hazama, to the extent that we would say that the first ones are not, that we don't believe the first ones at all. On the other hand, the Shach disagrees, and says that the Shach and the Nodi Behuda disagree, and say it's like any other Akasha, it's left as a suffix, and therefore, like Rashi said before, if the other guy mentioned in the Shtar, if the one mentioned in the Shtar is Toifus, the money, then we can't necessarily take it away from him, because there is, after all, a suffix. Whereas according to the Rivosh, we wouldn't have been able to do that. Okay. Continuing on, we said before in the Braisa that we brought at the beginning of the Sugya, Omamar, we said, Im Yesh Edim Shksav Yodim, who's there? We said, again, we have the case where Reuben and Shimon are signed on a shtar, they died, now other Edim, Levi and Yehuda, are coming, so now we said Levi, and so we had two cases, where we said now Yisachar and Zvulun are saying that they were Anusim, or what have you. Now we have two possible cases, we said. One is where first Levi and Yehuda come and say that this is their signatures, and then Yisachar and Zvulun come and say, yes, but they were Anusim. Or the other possibility we had, so we said, Im Yesh Edim, Shekhsav Yadim, who's there? If there were other Edim, that this is their Ksav Yad, Oishal Yekhsav Yadim, Yotzim, and Mokam Acher. Or if their handwriting, it can be verified from something else, namely Mishtar Shakora Olav Arar, the Hochsek Bebeistin, from a shtar that had been brought into question and then was confirmed in Beistin, then we say Ein Nemon, and then we don't believe the second set of Edim, Yisachar and Zvulun, because then we don't have a Pesha Asa Pesha Hitter anymore. And then again we have the Machloikas of Rav Sheshes and Rav Nachman. What does that mean? Does it mean that we can actually collect with the shtar, like Rav Sheshes says, or does it mean that we can't, like Rav Nachman says? So the Gemara says, So here we have also the machlokas between the Rama and the Rosh. Does it mean that the shtar literally has to have actually been questioned and brought to Beis Din for verification, or does it just mean that's the usual case when you would verify a shtar, but the same thing would apply equally well if it was verified for some, if it was in Skyim for some other reason. Anyway, so the Gemara says, Amri Nahar Doi, Ein Mekayim Nes Ashtar, here's other ways. Suppose you have the other Shtar that you want to compare with is not itself Mekoyim. So here we just said that if you have a Shtar that itself is Mekoyim, then you can verify based on it. Where that Shtar, again, was questioned, and then it was Mekoyim, they brought it to Beis Din, and Beis Din used one of the methods for Kiyum Shtaris, one of the ways of verifying the signatures, having the Edom themselves come, or having other Edom come, or comparing with other signatures on file, etc. So in all those cases, so you can verify, so now you can use that shtar in the future as a basis for verifying other shtaris. So now, what if you have no other shtar with these signatures that's Mekoyim? Then what can you do? So Amri Nahar Doi, so the Chacham of Nahar Doi said, Ein Mekayim Nes Ashtar, Elam Shtei Ksuvus, in order to be Mekayim Ashtar, in that case, you need to have two Ksuvus, or you have documents, deeds from two different fields. Only if the owners of those fields have already had chazaka of 3 years on those fields, b'shufi, meaning with perfection. Literally, the word shufi means quiet. Without iru, in other words, nobody during all those 3 years ever went and questioned their ownership of this field. So now, after 3 years, then we can use that shtar, the fact that they had a chazaka of 3 years and nobody came and called them to question all that time, that means the shtar is definitely genuine, otherwise somebody would have protested during this time, and therefore we can use that shtar, but we need two such shtaris as a basis for being Mekayim, or two ksubas. And in the case of the Ksubas, also, the Shittim Kobetzah says the same thing. You'd have to have that the couple has been married for 3 years and the Shufi, and nobody came and protested and said that maybe it wasn't a valid marriage or something. Omer of Shimi Ba'ashi, Ovi Yotzi Mitachas Yedei Acher. Now, Rav Shimi Ba'ashi says another condition is that these two Shtaris are in somebody else's hands. Avol miyad atzmai loy, but if they're in his own hands, no. So if Reuben is coming to us to Beis Din to be mekayim his shtar, he has a shtar that says that he lent money to Shimon and he wants to be mekayim it because Shimon is claiming that it's been forged or whatever. So now. If Reuven himself has possession of those two ksubas or those two shtaris of fields, then Rav Shimi Ba'ashi is saying that's no good. If Reuven has a friend who has such shtaris, or friends plural who have such shtaris, then he can bring them and then they can do it that way. So the Gemara says, "My shnat tachas yadat medeloi." So what's the problem if it's in his own hands? Apparently, the problem is dumazi yufamizayef. Presumably, the problem is because he could forge the whole thing. In other words, he could have forged the, let's say we're talking about two ksubas. He could have forged the two ksubas. Now he's forging a third document, all of them with seemingly the same signatures, and all of them are going to look the same because he forged all of them. So fine, we understand why it can't be in his possession. Which Tosfos points out, by the way, now there's a difference. When Beis Din looks at the signatures, sometimes there can be where Beis Din actually has to compare them one to the other. They have to actually look and see, we have this signature that we don't know whether it's genuine or whether it's forged. We have this other signature from this aid on file. Let's compare them and see. That's when we're saying that it would be no good if the one we're comparing against is in the possession of the one who wants to be Mekayim, the Shtar. But, says Tosfos, there can also be sometimes where Beis Din can just have Tvius Ayin. They can recognize. Sometimes you recognize somebody's signature on site, you don't really need to compare it. Then Tosfos says we wouldn't worry so much about anything being forged because then they would notice it. They would realize the difference. So we understand why they can't be in Reuven's own hands. Fine, but mitachas yedei acher nami. So why is it any better if it's in somebody else's possession? Duma ozel v'chazav v'asav v'zayif. What he could do, he could go over to Shimon, who has these shtaris in his possession, and go and look at what the signature is like and forge based on his memory of what they look like. And the answer is the Gemara says kula hayla matzah machab, and he's not going to be able to get it so exact if he does like that, just doing it from memory. But if he has them in his own
possession, then he's able to keep on transcribing and keep on tracing and copying them as many times as necessary till he gets it right. So therefore, we're concerned that he might be forging it. So that is why Rav Shimi Bar Ashi is saying that if the other shtaris are in somebody else's possession, then good. But if they're in his own possession, then no, we can't use those as a basis for being mekayim another shtar of his. Okay. More on the topic of Edim and their Edus and Shtaris. So till now we were talking about where an Edus signed on a Shtar, and we're talking about was the signature valid or not. Now we have kind of the other way around. Turn it up on Shtar. A person can write his Edus in a Shtar if he's concerned that he may forget it over time, or made alel filalacha kamashonim, and then he can be made on that even many years later. Based on what he said in the shtar. There are Rishonim who learn that what it means is that we're talking about basically he signed on a shtar, and then many years later he's coming and saying Edus based on seeing his signature. But most of the Rishonim learn it means the other way around. Let's say that it means that he saw something, so he goes and writes down in his diary that he saw such and such, and then years later when they ask him to give Edus, then he goes and looks in his diary and refreshes his memory, and then he says Edus. But Amar Rav Huna, Rav Huna says that would only work if he remembers it on his own. So at least, even without seeing, let's say the diary entry, he still would have remembered a bit of it. So he needs the details. So he looks there to find the details, but the basic fact he remembers even without it. Otherwise, Rav Huna says he can't give Edus on that basis. Rabbi Yechanan says, no, even if he doesn't remember it on his own at all, even if he has to look at it, even if he has to look at it to remember it at all. Now, Tosfos points out, and the Rambam says similarly, that if he doesn't remember at all, even after looking down at what's written over there, he cannot remember at all this episode, then he cannot say Edus at all. It has to at least be that once he sees what's written, then it jogs his memory, and then he remembers that, and then he remembers that he saw it. So that's Rabbi Yechanan. Omer Rabba, Shma Mina Midi Rabbi Yechanan. So Rabba says, we see, based on what Rabbi Yechanan is saying, Hani Beit She Diyadi Sadusa. Suppose you have two Edim who know some Edus, Uminshi Chad Minayu, and one of them forgot the Edus, Madka Chad B'chabre, then one of them can remind the other one. Because, again, by the same logic, if he's able to give Edus based on his own writing, then by the same token, he can give Edus based on the other aid reminding him. Well, Iboyolahu Asme Mai. So now the question becomes, what if the Baal Din himself reminds him? So what if the Baal Din says, so the Baal Din had previously lent money to somebody, now he needs Edus because the other guy is denying it, so he goes over to two people who he says, I remember you were there when you saw the loan take place. Do you remember it so that you can come and say Edus? Is that good, or are we concerned that maybe they're going to say yes, and they're going to say Edus falsely based on what he's telling them? So Rav Chaviva Amar Afilo Atzmai, Rav Chaviva says even he himself telling them is fine. If the aid remembers, then good, and if not, then he won't say Edus. Ma'abar Rav Ashi Amar Atzmai Loi, Ma'abar Rav Ashi says no, not if the Baal Din himself reminds them. V'hilchasa Atzmai Loi, and in fact the halacha is that if he himself reminds them, then no. So it's one thing that the Me'iri points out, when you have the other aid reminds him, the other aid has no negiyah in it. It's neither here nor there to him whether the Edus is going to be valid, so therefore he has no stake in the Edus being correct, so therefore when he reminds the other guy, we can assume that he's saying the truth. On the other hand, when the Baal Din himself is reminding him, you never know, he might be twisting things or shading things or whatever a little bit. Now, the Gemara says, V'itzurva Merabbanon, who, however, if he is a tzurva Merabbanon, then afilo atzmai, then it would work even himself. Now, who do we mean? Who is the he who is the tzurva Merabbanon? Rashi says it means the aid. So if the aid himself is a tzurva Merabbanon, as a Talmud Chacham, then even if the Baal Din is reminding him, then that aid can still, this aid, the Talmud Chacham, can still go and give aid. Why? Because we can rely on him that he knows how serious false Edus is, so we can assume that if he comes and gives the Edus, it means that he actually remembered it himself, and not so much because the Baal Din told him.
On the other hand, Rabbi High Goin brings Borton Shittim Kobetzes, and the Rambam brings that the who in our Gemara means the Baal Din. If the Baal Din is a Talmud Chacham, then we can assume he's not going to induce somebody else to do an Aveira. So therefore, when he tells the aide, would you come and then say Eidus for me? Then we can assume that he's not going to do it in a way that's going to be machshol the aid into saying edus on invalid basis, on the basis of having been reminded of it rather than remembering it himself. And the Gemara gives an example. We have an example where Rav Ashi one time knew some edus regarding Rav Kahana that would benefit Rav Kahana. So eventually when Rav Kahana was going to Beis Din about it, he asks, Rebbe, Rav Ashi, do you remember this edus? And Rav Ashi says no. And Rav Kahana says, wasn't it like that and like that? And still Rav Ashi says, I don't know. L'soif idka Rav Ashi, eventually Rav Ashi did remember it, and sure enough, he gave Eidos on Rav Kahana's behalf. Afterwards, Chazil Rav Kahana dava machasim. He saw afterwards Rav Kahana was like stumbling, hesitant about it. Can I really go to Beis Din with such Eidos when I had to remind you of it myself? Omalei, so Rav Ashi says, Mi sabrat aloch kasamichna. Do you think I'm relying actually on you? I know, diramoya nafshoi v'adkiri, I put it on myself to remember, I put on myself the responsibility to remember, and sure enough, eventually I remembered. So we see in this case, this is an example of Tzurvim and Abanon. So according to Rashi, the point is that the aid, Rav Ashi, is a Tzurvim and Abanon. According to Rav Hai Goin and the Rambam, the point is that the Baal Dover, that the Baal Din, Rav Kahana, is a Tzurvim and Abanon. Either way, the point is that works. And therefore, it was valid edus since we can trust Rav Ashi to remember on his own, and we can trust Rav Kahana to not remind him in a way that would be osur. Okay, so now the Gemara is going to take up a different topic, a topic in Hilchos Tumah V'Tahara, which is going to relate back to this matter of edim remembering their edus a long time later. So the Gemara says Tznan Hossam. We learn in a Mishnah in Masechta Ohalos. So it's talking about over there, about various cases where you have a suffix, whether a certain area is tummy mess or not. So the Mishnah says, Hatzlulios, mounds of dirt near the sides of the roads. Now, in those mounds of dirt, sometimes people bury dead bodies, or parts of dead bodies, or stillbirths. So the point is that in Eretz Yisrael, they wanted to be very careful. They knew that people have to be careful with Tumah V'Tahara in Eretz Yisrael. There are Koyanim who are eating Truma. There are Yisraelim who are going on Aliyah L'Regel. So on the roads themselves, they would be careful. But these mounds of dirt on the sides of the roads, nobody's climbing up them anyway, so therefore people would feel free to use them as burying places. So therefore the Mishnah says, HaKroivos, so if they're close, bein la'ir or bein la'derach, whether they're close to a city or whether they're close to a road, echad chadoshes ve'echad yeshanes, whether they're new mounds of dirt or whether they're old, they've been there a long time, either way, tmeis, they have a chazaka of being tame because dead bodies or stillbirths or what have you, or miscarriages might have been buried over there. So when the mound is old, then the problem is somebody may have been buried there a long time ago and everybody has since forgotten about it. Even the new ones, the problem is that if they buried a full body in there, then yeah, there would be a coil for it. But the problem is that sometimes a woman miscarries or has a stillbirth and she goes quietly on her own and buries it and she doesn't tell anybody. So even if it's a new mound, there's still the possibility that something like that happened. And therefore, that's true. If they're close to the city or close to the road, then people may go there by themselves. On the other hand, the Mishnah continues, Harachoikas, but if they're further away from the city or further away from the road, and we'll see soon how far is far, then Chadoshes Tahoris. Then if it's a new mound, then it's Tahor, because if it had been because somebody was actually buried, if they actually buried somebody there, then it would be well known. And if it was that a woman had buried a miscarriage over there, she wouldn't go there by herself because it's further away from the city. She'd be afraid of the danger. And if she went with other people, then they would let everybody know about it, because again, they want to make sure not to let there be unknown Tuma in Eretz Yisrael. Yeshon is Tmeis, but if it's old, then it's Tomei, because it might have been a long time ago. They buried a mess, and since then, a long time ago, they forgot. Thus far, the first part of the Mishnah, which is a Stam Mishnah. Now, within that, Ezehi Kroiva. So now we have to define what is the meaning of close. So Chamishim Amah. So it would be when it's within 50 Amos of the city or within 50 Amos of the road. So then that would mean, in other words, so according to this Tanna, we're going to say in a second, this is Reb Meir, according to Reb Meir, even if there are many such mounds, all within 50 Amos of the city, or all within 50 Amos of the road, all of them are going to be Becheskas Tumah. Only, because he's saying, only if they're outside 50 Amos, then we distinguish between new and old ones. He defines Kroiva as Chamishim Amah, when it's within 50 Amos of the city or of the road. The Ezehi Yeshana, and what's the definition of old? Shishim Shana, when it's been there for 60 years. Divrei Reb Meir. That's what Reb Meir says. Reb Yehuda disagrees on both things. He says Kroiva means She'ein Kroiva Hemena. The definition of Kroiva is there's no other mound closer to the road or closer to the city than it.
The Shittim Kubetzis brings a couple of possibilities. Does it mean, well, actually, so one second, as far as the, no, so actually we'll get back to that in a second, but, as far as, so if it's outside 50 Amos, then Rabbi Yehuda will agree it's called Rechoika. He's saying that if Kroiva means even within 50 Amos, only the one that's closest to the city or closest to the road will be considered Kroiva, all the other ones will be considered Rechoikas then. But if even the closest one is outside 50 Amos, then yes, that will be considered Rechoika as well. And as the Mishnah had said, if it's Rechoika, then if it's a new one, then it's Tahor, and only if it's an old one, then it's Tamei. And Rabbi Yehuda says, what is Yeshana? It means She'ein Adam Zoichra. The definition of Yeshana is where nobody remembers when that mound of dirt was formed. Which the Shittim Kubetzis brings a couple of possibilities. Does it mean that even it can be more than 60 years old, but if there's somebody who remembers when that mound was formed, then we would still consider it chadasha? Or would we say, if it's more than 50 amos away, or if it's not the closest one to the road, then it would be tahor? Or the other way of understanding Rabbi Yehuda is that it means that that for sure after 60 years we can assume nobody remembers it, but even within 60 years sometimes you can have where it's completely forgotten and then it would be tummy. So thus far the Mishnah. So now let's analyze my ir, my derech. What does the Mishnah mean when it mentions a city or a road? Ilema ir mamish derech mamish. Do you mean any old city or any old road? Then how could we say that just because of a suffix we're going to say that there might be tuma over there? Misfeka mimachsekin in tuma? Do we say because of a suffix that we're going to assume that there's tuma in stam a mound of dirt just because of the possibility that the tuma might have been buried in there? Va amar Rish Lakish, ilam matzav tiyoru eretz Yisrael. Didn't Rish Lakish say, as in a case over there where it describes in Masechta Nazir, a case where you have a suffix of tuma in Eretz Yisrael, and Rish Lakish says they found an ilah. The word ilah means an excuse. Like they found any old excuse for tiyaru Eretz Yisrael in order to declare Eretz Yisrael tahor. In other words, the Chachamim do not want to unnecessarily declare Eretz Yisrael to be tahor. So they'll use any excuse for that. Tosfos brings from Rabbeinu Hananel another meaning is the word ilah can be the word can be the Aramaic word for a rib is ilah. Ayin Yud Lamed Ayin Aleph. So very similar to the word Elah here in the Gemara. Ayin Yud Lamed Hey. So therefore it can mean they found one rib. In other words, they had an area where they had a chazakah that there was tumah over there. But then they found one rib over there and they said, you know what, that's why. Because of that one rib, then therefore that's why people consider this place to be tumah. Let's get rid of that rib. Let's bury it. And then in a known place, in a Beis HaKvaris, and then we can assume the rest of the area to be tahor. Either way, the point is, we try as much as possible not to assume that Eretz Yisrael is tumah. Why all of a sudden, just because we have a mound of dirt over there, which is within 50 amos of the road, are we going to assume that it's Tomei? So it can't just mean any old city or any old road. And for that matter, I mean, usually we say Suffolk Tumah B'Rishusar Abim Tahar. So actually what we're saying is that we don't even want to say it's a Suffolk. We want to say it's Vaday Tahar. So how can we say all of a sudden that we have a Suffolk of Tumah in these mounds? So the Gemara says, "Amar Rav Zeira, ir hasmuchol beis hakvaris." Doesn't just mean any old city; it means a city that's near the beis hakvaris. So we or the part of the city that's near the beis hakvaris. So therefore, there's a possibility that maybe instead of going all the way to the beis hakvaris, maybe they buried somebody over there.
And similarly, derech is derech beis hakvaris. Similarly, the word derech means a road to a city where there's a nearby beis hakvaris. So the Gemara says, b'shlema derech beis hakvaris. Okay, I can understand why when you have a mound of dirt near the road to a beis hakvaris, there's a possibility they buried a nest in there, because d'zimnin d'mesrami ben hashmoshes, it might happen that it comes, they're about to do a burial, they're carrying the nest, and it comes ben hashmoshes on Erev Shabbos, and they're in a rush, and they're not going to make it to the beis hakvaris before Shabbos, mikru v'kavru b'tel, so it can happen that they bury him in a mound of dirt over there. So therefore, so we understand why if it's near the road, why there's a possibility of tumah in there. Ella, ira, smuchel, beis hakvaris, but if it's a city that's near the beis hakvaris, so what's the problem? Kuli, the beis hakvaris, azli, everybody who lives in the city is going to bring their mesim to the beis hakvaris to bury them, and certainly they're not going to get caught short by the time, because they know how far it is to the beis hakvaris. So it's not like they're going to realize all of a sudden, hey, we're short on time, we better bury the mess on the way. So why would a city, why would there be a concern that there's anybody buried inside these mounds of dirt? So the Gemara answers, Amar of Chanina, it's not so much because they might bury full-size mesim in there. It's rather, mitoch shahanoshim kovras sham niflayen, because women bury their stillbirths, or their miscarriages, in these mounds of dirt, or mukish shchin zereisehem, and people who have shchin, which is a disease that causes parts of the body to fall off. It may be what's nowadays called leprosy, which is not the same as tzaras or tanach, it may be any of various other diseases, whatever it is, the point is, so they, when they have, like, their arm falls off, they would bury it in such a place. Now such things, stillbirths and beyond a certain point, and pieces of the body are metame, just like a mess, even though in the case of the arm, for example, it came from a living person, nevertheless, it's still metame, just as if it came from a dead person. Which, in this connection, by the way, there's a very interesting story that the Medrash tells about someone named Yosef HaKoyen, where he one time, he had a disease in his leg, he needed his leg to be amputated. Now his son was there to help his father through the operation. So he told Yosef tells the doctors, when the leg is attached just like by one thread, then let me know, please. So they get to that point, and then Yosef still has the presence of mind to tell his son, please leave the room, because as soon as they finish cutting off a leg, it's going to be metame ba'ohel, and you are going to become tame, and you, being my son or a kohen, you can't do that. So therefore, please leave. Me, I have no choice. They have to cut it off me, but you should leave. And the Chachamim were very pleased with Yosef HaKoyen for having the presence of mind to think of that even in a time like that, and they applied to him a pasuk in Kehelis, Yesh Tzadik Ovid B'Tzidkoi, which means that even you have a tzadik who's lost, like in this case, he's losing his leg, nevertheless B'Tzidkoi, he still retains his tzidkos, and he has the presence of mind to remember the halacha and to send even his own son out, so that his own son is not going to be there to help him during the final stage of it, just so that he doesn't become tummy. Anyway, the point is, So it's not so much that they might be in the middle of a levaya of a full-grown person and then have to bury him in the mound. You're right. The people living in the city would be able to time things better and not do that. But you have these women will go there and bury their stillbirths, and the mukesh chin will go and bury their arms or other body parts that fell off. So now the difference is, why do we say that rochok is 50 amos and korev is within 50 amos? Because ad chamishim amos, so up to 50 amos, the woman will go by herself to bury the stillbirth over there. Tfei, but if she goes any further than that, davra inish bada, she'll take along someone with her for safety, because there'll be safety in numbers. And the same thing, the mukesh shchin also. Now the mukesh shchin obviously don't have that consideration, but still they're going to try. They don't want to make any unnecessary tumah either. The Ramban explains. So therefore, or the Shittim Kubetzis rather explains. So therefore, if they know that women are going to stick to the ones within 50 amos, then they will also stick to the ones within 50 amos and not go further than that. So now that's why Rav Meir had said any ones that are within 50 amos are subject to that, and Rav Yehuda had said that only the closest one, because they would just use the closest one, they're not going to bother going any further out. But more than 50 amos, they should go with somebody else, or the Beis HaKvaris Ozla, so therefore she might as well go all the way to the Beis HaKvaris, as long as she has somebody to keep her company,
then so if she buries it in the mound, then that other person who's with her will make people aware of it, and that way they'll know from now on the mound is Tomei. Otherwise, though, by default, we assume they're going to go to the Beis HaKvaros, and then therefore there's no concern. So there may not be either way we don't have to worry about the mound. Either if they're buried in the mound, we would have heard about it because the other person would have told about it, or if they went to the Beis HaKvaros, then okay, they went to the Beis HaKvaros. Hilkach Tumah be'Eretz Yisrael lo machzikinan. So therefore, we don't want to be machzik Tumah in Eretz Yisrael, and therefore we're going to assume that we're not going to assume in that case, if it's further out than 50 amos, we're not going to assume that anything is buried in there. But again, that's with a city. When you have with a road, then we said the road, they may bury it by the side of the road because they're in a hurry. But even then, the point is that if they bury it more than 50 amos away, then they will inform people and it'll become well known. And again, if there's no Beis HaKvaros in the city at all, then nobody's going to bury anything at all anyway. The Shittim HaKabetza says, for the same reason as before, because they don't want to add extra Tumah in Eretz Yisrael, so therefore they would just take their stillbirth or their arm and bury it someplace else. Okay, so now that we analyze that Mishnah and we understand it, and we mentioned a point about 60 years, where we said that Reb Meir says that up to 60 years, we assume that that people will remember when this mound was formed, but after that, not necessarily, and therefore there might be something buried in it, and nobody remembers. So Amar Rav Chisda, Shema Mina Mira Meir, we see from what Reb Meir is saying, when it comes to Eidos, you're only going to remember it for up to 60 years, but not more than that. So therefore, when we said before, for example, that a person has a diary entry where he wrote down his Eidos or whatever, if it's more than 60 years old, we can't accept that Eidos, Sir Chista says, at least according to the mayor. On the other hand, Veloihi, but the Gemara says not so. Not necessarily is that opinion of Rav Chisda valid. Because the difference is, when it comes to the burial of a mess, it's not particularly incumbent on him to remember. So therefore, eventually everybody forgets about it because nobody thinks they have a particular responsibility to remember it. Avalhocha, but when it comes to Eidos over here, given to Romi Ale, since it's incumbent on him, he, after all, was an aide, and he knows, without me, there's not going to be anybody else, Afilu Turbanami, then maybe even beyond 60 years, he would remember. And furthermore, actually, the Beis Yosef adds that maybe that's only according to the mayor. According to the Behuda, we may not even need that. According to the Behuda, we may well say that since it's incumbent on him, Rabbi Yehuda, after all, didn't say the 60 years. He just said when nobody remembers it. So therefore, according to Rabbi Yehuda, there's not necessarily a time limit of 60 years even for something that you're not responsible to remember. As long as you remember it, then it's good, and therefore Rabbi Yehuda, rather, would allow that even beyond 60 years.